Good evening. So just before Christmas, Randy tracked me down. He says, Dan, I got you down for February 5th while I'm in the Philippines. I thought, February 5th, okay, this is Christmas already. Probably not going to get anything done over the holidays. So it gives me about a month. Well, I guess I can handle that. Yeah, Randy, I'm good. Put me down for the 5th. All right, and then the holidays passed, like I knew they would. I didn't get anything done. And so I started thinking right after the new year, okay, I gotta get on track this time because this usually takes me a while. I gotta start thinking of a topic, what I want to preach on. And then I looked at the Lord's Supper list, and sure enough, I've got the bread sometime in January. And I got a text from Mitch. He's got me down for teaching the high school class starting in another month. Okay, no problem, good still. I can do this. But something else that was weighing on me at the time is my kids are getting older, and they're facing challenges and things that come up in their life, and I felt like I needed to sit down and talk with them about stuff that's going on and have these conversations with them, and I wanted to be prepared for the conversation, so I wanted to look at some scriptures and be able to talk to them about it. And so now it's starting to get a little much. And I knew what I would do is I would do the lesson and then the conversations, they would just slip off like they had been for a while already. But I decided, okay, otherwise I got to start combining something. I got to either tie my lesson into the high school class material, or what I ended up doing was combining my conversations with my kids with the lesson. So the title of tonight's lesson is Conversations with My Kids. My kids will be relieved to know that this is not a line-by-line document of our conversations. I'm going to take some ideas, three ideas, from these conversations that overlapped a little bit into each one of the things that I wanted to talk to them about. And so I'm going to present three ideas tonight for us to consider. The first one is going to be about temptation. And I wanted to emphasize that temptations come with danger, real danger, and we need to respect that danger. And we also need to find a way to stay away from the temptations as much as we can in our lives. So let's start by looking at 1 Peter chapter 5. Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. So the devil is dangerous. He's like a lion. But when I thought about it, the temptations that come in our life can't exactly be characterized like this. If this lion was hunting, he's just now guaranteed that he's not going to eat dinner tonight. Because he just chased off anything that he's going to catch for dinner. And I think the temptations that come in our life are more like this lion. If you can't see the lion, well, that's kind of the point. Temptations are sneaky. They can sneak up on us. They're silent. They're often disguised. Disguised as fun or exciting or profitable or easy, and on and on and on. But if temptations are so hard to spot, how can we stay away from them? Well, we can start with respect. And I don't mean admiration in respect in that way, like respect for our elders. I mean respect in the sense is more of awareness. Respect for the temptations and the power that they have to ruin, to bring ruin to our lives. And more importantly, our relationship with God. When we respect the power temptations have in our lives, we'll be more motivated to keep our distance. When I respect that this lion has the power to rip me limb from limb, I'm going to think twice about running through that tall grass. When we respect the warnings God gives us in His Word, warnings that temptations start with our own desires and then lead to sin and ultimately lead to death and separation from God, we can resist the devil. But can we stay away from temptation completely? I believe the Bible makes it clear that temptations are going to come in our lives. So what can we do? The Bible's message is pretty clear. We have to run. When we see temptations in our life, we have a choice to make. We can stay or we can run. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, flee from sexual immorality. 1 Timothy chapter 6, but as for you, O man of God, flee from these things. And 2 Timothy chapter 2, so flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness. So we have a choice. We can be like this guy on the right. He sees the temptation, but he doesn't respect the risk. He doesn't see the cracks in the cliff. He isn't sinning. He hasn't fallen in yet. The guy on the left, he knows what God warns us about. He knows there is too much to risk, too much at stake to take a chance and stay on the edge. So we know what we need to do. We need to be the guy on the left. But how often are we the guy on the right? How often do we convince ourselves that there's no risk, there's no cracks, we're good to stay on the edge and get as close to sinning without falling in? One of the problems I think we face is the chasm of sin here. It's full of people. It's full of people that we know. Friends, co-workers, even family members. They're already in there. Unaware or unwilling to admit the severity of their choices, anyone that's not willing to join them is considered odd or strange or out of place. Even the guy standing on the edge is not going to fit in with the world until he falls. The guy on the left, he will never fit in with the world. He can expect to be ridiculed and persecuted for his choice to avoid temptation. Even from the guy that's on the ledge. When we choose to run from temptation, we can expect to be running alone. Another problem is we can convince ourselves that the edge is a good place to be. We can be overly confident in our ability to resist temptations. We can't see the cracks in the cliff. We know they might be there, but we convince ourselves that the chances are small. Maybe we stood on the cliff before and nothing happened. Paul warns us in 1 Corinthians 10, "Therefore, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Our overconfidence in ourselves can make us blind to the warning signs. I found a quote on the internet relating to this verse that kind of summed up what I was looking for. It says, "When we feel ourselves beginning to dislike those who warn us against sin, and when we find ourselves measuring the smallest distance that we can place between ourselves and some desired object of indulgence without actually sinning, then let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." If we listen to God's warnings, we know what we have to do. We have to run. We have to put as much room as we can between us and the temptations in our life. The next topic is about God's design for relationships in our life. And specifically, I'm talking about the marriage relationship. God has designed this relationship, and he has designed it specifically for us. And he has designed it as the best thing for us, if we'll just follow his design. Starting in Genesis chapter 2. "Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Ephesians chapter 13. "However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." And then Jesus tells us in Mark chapter 10, "But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." These verses make it very clear that God's design for a lasting relationship includes a husband and a wife. Doesn't include a boy and the girl that he just met at the bar. It doesn't include a man and his live-in girlfriend. It certainly doesn't include a husband and a husband, or a husband and a question mark. Husband and wife. In all those verses, very clear from the very beginning of time, God has designed the marriage relationship for a husband and a wife. He also has a purpose for this relationship. He has a design of how it starts, how it works, and how it ends. It starts off, "The man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife." It works, the husband loving his wife and the wife respecting her husband throughout the years of their life together. And then it ends in God's design. "Let not man separate what God has joined," or "until death do we part." But man, at times, a lot of times, doesn't like God's way. He doesn't like God's plan. So he comes up with his own way. And he's all over the map. Then that doesn't work out so well. So he tries to think of another way. But he gets the same results. But more and more determined, he comes up with another plan, even further from God's plan. But the results are all the same every time. The best chances that we have at a lasting, fulfilling relationship is to follow God's plan for marriage from beginning to end. Well, what does it take for us to follow that plan? It takes the computer cooperating. Okay. It takes patience. It takes patience for us to wait for God's plan to take its course. So many times the world wants to jump that plan. They want to move everything out of order. And it doesn't work out. It takes hard work. For those years in between, it takes a lot of hard work between the husband and the wife. And it takes a lot of faith. It takes a lot of faith that even when it feels like it's not going to work, faith in God, that if we follow his plan, follow his design for our marriage, that it will indeed work out in the end. So let's turn to Genesis chapter 16 in our Bibles. We're going to look at Abraham. We're going to look at a time in his life when he wasn't patient and he didn't follow God's plan. Genesis chapter 16, we see Abraham and Sarah, and they're waiting for the promised, God's promise to be fulfilled. This great nation that's going to come from Abraham, and they do not have a single child. Abraham is 86 at this point, and Abraham and Sarah are getting impatient. Starting in verse 1. Now Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abram, "Behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go to my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abraham listened to the voice of Sarah. So Abram lived 10 years in the land of Canaan. Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. And Sarah said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarah, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." Then Sarah dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. And on the story goes. We see that Abram and Sarah's impatience, they tried to come up with their own solution. They didn't want to wait for God's plan to unfold. And it fell apart. Chaos ensued. Stress, drama in the family. Ishmael comes out of this situation, and his descendants would end up being a thorn in Israel's side for years to come. And all because of impatience. All because of not the lack of faith to follow God's design. God's way, from start to finish, husband and wife, patience, hard work, and faith. The best guarantee that we have at a long-lasting, fulfilling relationship. The last point I want to cover is related to picking a spouse. Years ago, I remember Dick Milwey explaining something in a in a Bible class, I think, or it could have been a lesson. But he described the act of picking who you're going to marry as being the second most important decision that we have to make in our lives. Let's see if I can get it back on track. Here we go. Okay, here we go. Okay, so ranking the decisions that we make in our life from least important to most important. And starting at least important. What are we doing for dinner? It's coming. It's coming here in just a few minutes. And it comes up over and over again, but in the rankings, it's way down at the bottom. It has very little effect on our lives. Somewhere in the middle, what should I do for work? How do I provide for my family? How many kids am I going to have? Where am I going to live? These decisions are a little more important. But in the end, there's two decisions left, number one and number two. Number one, what am I going to do about salvation? The most single most important decision that any person has to make in their lives. And there in a close second is who am I going to marry? And surprisingly, it's there in second place because that decision can heavily affect the first one. So let's look at some verses. Starting in Proverbs 31. An excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. Proverbs 21. It is better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. Proverbs 31, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. There's some verses about the wife. Let's look at 1 Samuel 25 for an example of a husband of sorts. 1 Samuel chapter 25. I think it's 25. Okay, there it is. Chapter 25, we're going to start in verse 2. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved, and he was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you and peace be to your house and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us and we did them no harm. And they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. And when David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David. And then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword." And every man strapped on his sword, and David did as well. So skipping down to verse 14. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm." And we're going to skip down to 17. "Now therefore know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, for he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." Now this is the servant telling the master's wife how worthless the master is. If she were to report him back to the master, he would be severely beaten or worse. Nabal must be such a worthless man that he even feels confident that he can tell his wife how worthless he is, and he won't suffer rebuke for it. So the story goes on that Abigail actually saves her husband from David's wrath, intercepts David before David can get to her husband, and makes a reasonable plea for David to turn away from killing Nabal. So David turns away, he agrees, and then Abigail goes back to the house. Well, Nabal's having a huge party that night, and he's pretty drunk. And by the time he wakes up in the morning, Abigail tells him all that has happened. And from what the scriptures described, let's go to verse 37. "In the morning when wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died." Worst husband ever. So what can we learn? What do we need? What do young people need to know when it's time for them to look for a spouse? The world wants you to look, see if they're attractive, if they have a sense of humor, if you have similar interests, blah, blah, blah. We need some more important. We need some more substance to look for. We might try these kind of questions. Do they love me more than they love themselves? Is serving God the highest priority in their life? Do they help me to be a stronger servant of God? Or maybe the opposite. Do they distract me from being a better servant of God? These important questions, they need to be asked early and often. And if you don't get the right answers, there's only one thing to do. And as hard as that may be to do, we're going to look at somebody who didn't do that. We're going to look at Solomon. Solomon, the wisest king in the history of Israel. So wise that in his youth he asked God for wisdom for his rule over Israel. And God blessed him with that wisdom. But when it came to picking a spouse, Solomon was not so wise. Solomon had many, many wives, and many of them came from the daughters of Canaan, as God had instructed them not to do. And the scriptures tell us that Solomon's wives came into the relationship with their idolatry, and Solomon allowed those relationships to pull him away from God, and he followed his wives into that idolatry. I have one last scripture to look at. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with dark? So that covers the conversations with my kids. The conversations, they went pretty well. I think I put them off for a while because they were not the most comfortable conversations to have. But in the end, I was happy that we had the conversations, and I think they were important to have. My one regret is that maybe I waited too long. Maybe these conversations should have been happening earlier in their lives. Maybe they could have been better prepared earlier in their lives. So that brings the lesson to a close. Before we leave tonight, we want to offer an invitation for anyone that has any spiritual need. If you want to, you can come forward while we stand and sing.